Chapter 10. The Sixth Harbinger. The Sycamore. He said the image was clear. So what was it? She asked. A tree, he replied. A tree as in the prophecy? Yes, as in the very next words of the prophecy. So the harbingers were being revealed to you in the same order as they appeared in Isaiah 9:10. In the exact same order, he said. The prophecy moves from the stone to the sycamore. But we will rebuild with quarried stone. The sycamores have been cut down. So the tree on the seal, it was a sycamore, she asked. That's what I assumed. So where did it lead you? I went deeper, as before, into the original language, to find the Hebrew behind the word sycamore. And you found? Shakam. The word translated as sycamore is the Hebrew shakam. It's also known as the fig mulberry tree. How do you get sycamore from that? The Greek word for fig is sukkos, and for mulberry is moros. Put them together, you get sycamoros, or sycamore. Its Latin name is the Ficus sycamoris, a wide-spreading tree that reaches a height of about 50 feet. In biblical times, they grew in Israel's lowlands and along the roads and highways. So you did your homework, and I pursued it. I even took my quest to the New York Botanical Gardens. But it didn't lead me any closer to the mystery of the sixth harbinger. In fact, it led me farther away. The more I learned about the sycamore, the farther I was from the answer. Why? What could the cutting down of a sycamore tree possibly have to do with America or 9/11? The ancient Assyrians may have been interested in cutting down sycamores, but not the terrorists of 9/11. They targeted cities, not forests or farmlands. How could the cutting down of a sycamore tree have anything to do with it? There was no connection. That was my first problem. But the second was fatal. Which was? It doesn't grow here. Not in the American Northeast. Not naturally. The Ficus sycamoris is native to the Middle East and Africa. It doesn't grow in climates with frost. The only way you could keep it alive in New York or in Washington, D.C. is to keep it inside or wrapped up in blankets and plastic. And some people actually do that, but it's a novelty. The sycamore of Isaiah 9:10 is alien to the American Northeast. So 9/11 had nothing to do with trees, and the sycamore has nothing to do with the Northeast, so what did you do? After a few more dead ends, I gave up trying. I figured that, somehow, whatever I was supposed to know, I would end up knowing. And did you end up knowing? I ended up in Central Park, on the lake, in a rowboat. It's something I do when I need to clear my mind. There's a bridge there, a walking bridge, which stretches over the water in a long arch. If you're in a rowboat, you can pass underneath, which is what I did, twice. The first time going out, the second time coming back in. It was the second time, just as I was emerging from underneath, that I noticed a man on the bridge as I looked up. He was standing in the middle of the bridge with both hands resting on the railing and looking down, at me, I think, but I wasn't sure. The prophet? Yes. And you didn't see him the first time you passed under the bridge? I don't even know if he was there when I first went through. So what happened? I stopped rowing, and I shouted up at him, "Is that you?" I just wanted to make sure. "Who else could I be but me?" came the response. "It's definitely you," I said softly. "And how's your search going, Noriel?" he asked. "How does it look like it's going? I'm in a rowboat, on a lake, in Central Park. Not very well." "But you're in a place of trees." "Is this the place of our next meeting?" "I guess it is." "Then how do we meet?" "Either you get out of the boat and join me on the bridge, or I get off the bridge and join you in the boat. I'd recommend the latter." So we came down from the bridge while I navigated the boat to the side to find a place from which he could get in, which he did. It was now me and the prophet in a rowboat, on a lake, in Central Park. There were several other boats in the water that day, but from the moment he joined me, everything else faded into the background as the focus turned to an ancient mystery and the future of a nation. We could have been anywhere. "And you continued rowing as you spoke?" "Yes, as we spoke, and as I recorded." He was quiet for a time. We both were. As the boat neared the middle of the lake, the prophet broke the silence. So, Nouriel, what have you found so far? The sixth harbinger is the sycamore from Isaiah 9:10, but we will rebuild with quarried stone. The sycamores have been cut down. And why do you think the sycamores would have been cut down? He asked. It had to be the Assyrians in their invasion, part of devastating the land. And why would a fallen sycamore be significant? That's as far as I got. If the fallen bricks foreshadow the nation's future collapse, what did the fallen sycamore foreshadow? I don't know. It's a sign of uprooting, the uprooting of a kingdom. Do you have the seal, Noriel? I gave it to him. He held it up as he began to reveal its meaning. The sixth harbinger. The destruction isn't limited to buildings. The enemy's attack causes the sycamore to be cut down. The fallen sycamore is a sign of warning, and in the ignoring of the warning, becomes a prophecy of judgment. The sixth harbinger, the sign of uprooting, the sycamore. But what does it have to do with America? The agents of Al-Qaeda weren't interested in sycamores. And the sycamore of Isaiah 9:10 grows in the Middle East and Africa, not anywhere near the events of 9/11. That's true, he said. So I don't see how anything could connect. The chances of don't mean anything. What do you mean? In the last moments of the calamity, the North Tower began to collapse. In the midst of that collapse, it sent debris and wreckage through the air toward a plot of land at the border of Ground Zero. It was unlike the other properties surrounding Ground Zero in that it wasn't covered with concrete, steel, or asphalt, but with soil and grass. I stopped rowing and let the boat glide. He paused for a moment before continuing. The wreckage hurled by the falling tower struck an object. An object? What kind of an object? A tree? No. After the cloud of dust began to clear, police officers, rescue workers, and onlookers gazed at the little plot of land at the edge of Ground Zero. There, in the middle of the ash and debris that covered the ground, was a fallen tree. It would soon become a symbol of 9/11 and of Ground Zero, and it was a symbol, but one much more ancient than anyone there could have realized, and one carrying a message no one could have fathomed. What tree was it? I asked. The tree that was struck down, he answered. What kind of tree was it? It was a sycamore tree. The tree at Ground Zero that was struck down on September 11th was a sycamore tree. But how, I asked. How could it? They don't grow here. When the American leaders declared, "We will rebuild," the same words of Israel's ancient vow, did they proclaim it in ancient Hebrew? No, of course not, I replied. And why not, he asked. Because American leaders don't speak ancient Hebrew, and who would have understood it? Exactly. In each case, the ancient and the modern, the leaders speak in the tongue of their people and nation. The harbinger is translated into the context of the nation in which it appears and to the people to whom it's directed. So too with the sign of the sycamore. It was a translation. A translation? How? The tree matches the nation, the land. The tree of Isaiah 9:10 was endemic to Israel. So the tree of 9/11 was endemic to America. But you said it was a sycamore. It's classified under the genus Platanus, but it's known by its common English name, sycamore. It was a sycamore. But, yes, you were right, Noriel. The Middle Eastern sycamore doesn't naturally grow in the American Northeast, but there exists a version of the sycamore that does, the English sycamore. The English sycamore, a translation of the harbinger. And it was the English sycamore that happened to be growing on the little plot of land at the border of Ground Zero. And it was named sycamore because it was named after the Middle Eastern sycamore. So the tree that was struck down on 9/11 was named after the tree of Isaiah 9:10? Yes. The ancient Middle Eastern harbinger was translated into Western form, into an American tree bearing the same name of the Middle Eastern tree of Israel's judgment. And it just happened to be standing there on the corner of Ground Zero on 9/11. Just as everything else, he said. It just happened to be. But the Assyrians intended to cut down the sycamore tree. The terrorists of 9/11 didn't. The terrorist had no idea of Isaiah 9:10, no idea of the harbingers, no idea of the sycamore tree growing at the corner of Ground Zero, and no idea that their attack would cause it to fall or that its fall was connected to an ancient prophecy. They had no idea, but it still happened. And what happened after it fell, I asked. It became the focal point of interest and attention. It was transformed into a symbol. Just as with the harbingers before it. The harbingers are, among other things, symbols. So the sycamore became a symbol of 9/11. It was labeled the sycamore of Ground Zero. Articles were written about it. It was placed on public display. Crowds gathered around to see it. But they had no idea of the message it carried or how far-reaching that message was. Nor did they take note of the small object entwined in its roots, which was a brick, he replied. The bricks have fallen, and the sycamores have been cut down. The whole thing is, I can't even put it into words, everything replaying itself, everything following the details of an ancient prophecy. Now even inanimate objects, the tower, the stone, the tree, and with nobody orchestrating it. With nobody orchestrating it because it had to happen. The harbingers manifested because they had to manifest, as signs, as prophetic messages. And what message does the sign of the sycamore hold for America, I asked. It's a sign of a fall, of a cutting down, an uprooting, an end. When it appeared in ancient Israel, it prophesied the nation's downfall and the end of its kingdom. And now it reappears for America. So does that mean that there has to be an... It's a warning, said the prophet. It all depends if the warning is heeded. And if it's not heeded? If a tree falls to the ground and no one hears it, does it make a sound? Does it? I asked. In the case of the sycamore, it makes two. Two? For those who hear it, the sound of warning and the call to redemption. And for those who don't, the sound of judgment. We were silent for a time. Then he reached into his coat pocket and handed me the next seal. I examined it without saying anything, placed it in my pocket, then resumed rowing to bring the boat back into the dock. And what clue do you have for me concerning the seventh harbinger? I asked as we neared the dock. It's as clear as the one before it, he replied. And closely joined. Closely joined to the sycamore, yes. It's another image of a tree, but different. Correct. There are two trees in the prophecy, I said. So the seventh harbinger has to be the second tree. You see, Noriel, it's not so hard. You've already figured out all that, and without even spending weeks searching for the answer, and we haven't even reached the dock. Then why do we need weeks or months before the next meeting? For you to work on it. Why don't we just keep going, here? It's a place of trees. The setting works. He thought for a moment, then responded, why not then? Then we'll do it here? Why not? He repeated. I never expected him to agree to the suggestion. It threw me. It threw me enough to question him. So, a prophet can change the plan? The appointed plan? Who said the plan was changed? But I was the one who came up with the idea. And how do you know that your coming up with the idea to change the plan wasn't the appointed plan in the first place? If it was a change of plan, then it wasn't appointed. And if it was appointed, he replied, then it wasn't a change of plan. So you're saying you planned to continue here all along, before I mentioned it? Whether I planned it, or whether it happened because it was planned without my planning it, makes no difference. I think you're just saying all this. And you're free to think that, he replied. So I'm free to think that. I don't have to think that. But that doesn't mean it wasn't planned, he added. How could it be both, I asked. It takes two oars to make a boat go straight. Meaning it's both free will and predestination? Meaning... You need to use both oars and focus on keeping the boat straight, so it can make it back to dry land. Chapter 11. The Seventh Harbinger, the Erez Tree. She rose from her chair. "Noriel, would you excuse me for a moment before we continue?" "Of course," he answered. She walked over to her desk. "Is everyone gone?" she asked, speaking into the phone set. "Yes," replied the voice on the speaker. "Everyone's gone, and I'll be leaving soon. You'll make sure everything's turned off?" "I will." During the exchange, Noriel gazed out to the city skyline. It was now early evening. The sun had set. The city was illumined by the deep blues and reds of twilight and the incandescent and fluorescent radiance of its buildings and street lamps. "So," she said, as she returned to the round table, "you were in the boat with the prophet. We docked, got out of the boat, and began walking through the park. He led me to the fountain on the terrace, the one with the statue of the angel on top." "Do you know what that is, Noriel?" he asked. "An angel," I replied. "This is Bethesda Fountain, and that's called the Angel of the Waters. It's from the Gospel of John, the account of a crippled man who waited by the pools of Bethesda in Jerusalem to be healed. And do you know what Bethesda means?" "No," I replied. "It comes from the Hebrew word chesed, which means mercy or loving kindness. Bethesda means the house of mercy or the place of the loving kindness. Chesed, mercy, love. It's God's nature, his essence. Don't forget that. Through all this, don't forget that. Judgment is his necessity, but his nature and essence, his heart, is love. He's the one always calling out to the lost to be saved." We resumed our walk, passing by others in the park, also walking or running or playing chess or just sitting in the park benches, doing nothing in particular. We followed the walking path through a lush green landscape of trees and grass, rocks and bridges. "So, Noriel, if the sycamore is the sixth harbinger, then the seventh harbinger has to be the cedar. It's what comes next. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will plant cedars in their place."
"Correct."
"So the tree on the seal is a cedar."
"Yes."
"And what does it mean?"
"I have no idea."
"Their sycamores are fallen. They vow to replace them. But instead of replacing them with other sycamores, they replace them with cedars. Why do you think they would do that?"
"It would have to be for the same reason they didn't replace the fallen bricks with other bricks, but with quarried stone. The goal wasn't restoration, but defiance. So I'd guess that the cedar was stronger than the sycamore, or as different from the sycamore as quarried stones were from clay bricks."
"You're right. The sycamore was a common tree. It was never seen as something of great value. Its grain was coarse, knotty, spongy, and not particularly strong. And though its wood could be used in construction, it was neither the most ideal nor most durable material to build with. So it was kind of the clay brick of trees."
"Exactly.
And as the clay bricks were replaced by massive stones, the fallen sycamore would be replaced by the cedar. So the cedar was stronger than the sycamore, much stronger, and much more highly valued. The sycamore grew in the lowlands. The cedar grew on mountain heights. The sycamore was common. The cedar was exotic. Unlike the twisting sycamore, the cedar was straight, majestic, and towering. Its wood was smooth, durable, and perfectly suited for construction. The sycamore could reach a height of about 50 feet, but the cedar could grow to well over 100. That was the point. They would plant cedars in place of the fallen sycamores. And unlike the sycamore, the cedar would stand strong against any future attack, or so they hoped. One commentary puts it this way: instead of hearkening, heeding, and repenting, the nation determines to act in a spirit of defiance. It will exchange its feeble sycamores that are cut down for strong cedars, which the wildest gales will spare." "The wildest gales would be what?" he asked.
"The nation's coming day of judgment," I replied.
"Yes, and on that day nothing would be spared. Not the trees, not the stones, not the nation.
and the kingdom would fall as quickly and violently as a cedar crashing down to the earth. So it's the same thing they did with the quarried stone, the same act in a different form. They laid the quarried stone in the place of fallen bricks. Now they plant the cedar in the place of the sycamore. It's the act of halaf, he said. Halaf. It's the Hebrew word used in the verse. It means to exchange, to replace, to plant one thing in the place of another. And what about the word cedar, I asked. Cedar is English. What's the original word used in the prophecy? What was the tree called in Hebrew? Erez. It was called the Erez. The sycamores have fallen, but we will plant Erez trees in their place. So Erez means cedar, I asked. Yes and no, he replied. Cedar is the word most often used to translate Erez, as in the cedars of Lebanon. But Erez means much more than the English cedar. Come. With that, he left the path and led me over to a tree. How would you describe it, Nouriel? It's an evergreen. And what else? It has cones, and its leaves are needle-like. It's a coniferous tree, a conifer. The classic botanical work known as Hierobotanicon defines the Hebrew Erez as a conifer or coniferous tree. The word Erez also appears in several different ancient texts, where it refers to an evergreen conifer. So an Erez tree is a coniferous evergreen. Yes, he replied, but not every coniferous evergreen is necessarily an Erez tree. So what exactly is it, I asked. Most specifically, it's a particular kind of cone-bearing evergreen. One commentator more narrowly pinpoints it. The Hebrew Erez, rendered cedar in all English versions, is most likely a generic word for the pine family. And that means what, exactly? The Erez tree would fall under the botanical classification of Panacea. Panacea. And what, I asked, does Panacea refer to specifically? The cedar, the spruce, the pine, and the fir. So the most accurate identification of the Hebrew word Erez would be Panacea tree. Yes, the most botanically precise translation of the vow would be, but we will plant Panacea trees in their place. And the Panacea includes the cedar, but more than the cedar. Correct. So they plant the stronger tree in place of the weaker, as they vow a stronger nation to replace a weaker one. The Erez tree becomes another symbol of the nation and its defiance, a living symbol of their confidence in their national resurgence, their tree of hope. A tree of hope, but not a good hope. No, he replied. A prideful, self-centered, and godless hope. What they saw as a tree of hope was in reality a harbinger of judgment. He asked me for the seal, so of course I gave it to him. And lifting it up in his right hand, as he had done with the others, he began to reveal its mystery. The seventh harbinger, the warning of the fallen sycamore, goes unheeded. Its uprooted remains are removed. Another tree is brought to the place of its fall. A Hebrew Erez, a conifer, an evergreen, the biblical cedar, the Panacea tree. The Erez tree is planted in the same spot where the fallen sycamore had once stood. The planting is vested with symbolic meaning. The second tree becomes a symbol of national resurgence, confidence, and hope. But like the quarried stone, in reality, it embodies the nation's defiance. It will stand as a witness of a nation's false hope and a living omen of its rejection of the warning given, the seventh harbinger, the Erez tree. So the sign is the appearance of the Erez tree. Yes, it's planting. Yes, it's planting, and in the place of the fallen sycamore. If that happens, the seventh harbinger is manifested. Yes. At that point, we resumed our walking. And has the seventh harbinger manifested, I asked? It has. How? It began with the removing of the sycamore of ground zero. Yes. It was taken from the place of its fall and put on public display as a symbol of the calamity. Even its root system would be carefully removed and transferred to another site. But for the ancient mystery to play out, I said, another tree would have to be brought to the same plot of land and planted in the same place where the sycamore had stood. In late November of 2003, 2 years after the fall of the sycamore, a strange sight appeared at the corner of Ground Zero. In the sky, a tree. It was being transported by crane over a courtyard of soil and grass. Those in charge of the operation carefully guided it down to the appointed spot. The new tree was set into position to stand on the same spot where once had stood the sycamore of Ground Zero. What was it? What kind of tree? The most natural thing to have done would have been to replace the one sycamore with another. But the prophecy required that the fallen sycamore be replaced with a tree of an entirely different nature. So the tree that replaced the sycamore of Ground Zero was likewise not a sycamore. According to the prophecy, the sycamore must be replaced by the biblical erez, so it must be replaced by a conifer tree. And the tree that replaced the sycamore of Ground Zero? The tree that replaced the sycamore was a conifer tree. An evergreen? Yes, with needle-like leaves and cones. They replaced the fallen sycamore with the erez tree, the sign of a nation's false hope and defiance before God. It's like something out of a movie. It's surreal, except that it's real. Who was behind the decision to do that? I asked. No one, he answered. No one in the sense of any one person making it all happen or trying to fulfill the prophecy. No one had any idea what they were doing? No one. Then where did it come from? The tree was a gift donated from an outside party, just as was the gazit stone that replaced the fallen bricks. But you narrowed the word erez down more specifically to one particular kind of conifer, the panacea tree. And the tree that was lowered into the ground? Its Latin name was Picea albis. And the tree that replaced the sycamore was a panacea tree. A panacea tree, the same tree of the ancient prophecy, the same tree that had to replace the fallen sycamore, unbelievable, and the sister tree to the cedar of Lebanon. And it all took place at the corner of Ground Zero? Yes. And the replacing of the bricks with a gazit stone happened at Ground Zero? Yes. So both parts of the ancient prophecy were fulfilled in the same place, at Ground Zero. And not only in the same place, he said, but in the same way. What do you mean? They didn't just place a gazit stone on Ground Zero. They made it into a public event, a public gathering completely centered around the harbinger. So it was with the replacing of the sycamore by the erez tree. The act became a public event, a gathering completely centered on the harbinger. And who led the event? A local spiritual leader. So the planting of the erez tree was made into a ceremony? A ceremony centered on the act of replacement, as the laying down of the gazit stone was an act of replacement. Each event centered on one of the harbingers. Neither had anything to do with repentance. Instead, each exalted the human spirit and its defiance of calamity. It was another echo of the ancient vow. 2,500 years earlier, the people of Israel responded to their calamity by planting the erez tree as a sign of their defiant, self-confident hope. Now, in the aftermath of 9/11, and against the backdrop of Ground Zero, the assembled New Yorkers repeated the ancient act with their new erez tree. They, too, transformed it into a sign. During that ceremony, the officiant bestowed on the tree a name. He proclaimed, "This Ground Zero Tree of Hope will be a sign of the indomitable nature of human hope." A tree of hope, said the prophet, and a sign. Yes, of the indomitable nature. Indomitable, meaning unconquerable. The spirit of the vow. And in the vow, what word was used for this act? You just told me, chalaf, which means to exchange, to replace, to plant something in the place of another. So that's exactly what has to be fulfilled. It's not just that one tree has fallen and a new one planted, but the new tree has to be planted in the same place. The Erez tree must be planted in the same place where the fallen sycamore had once stood. Now listen to the words they proclaimed that day as they gathered around the Erez tree. The tree of hope is planted in the very spot where a 60-year-old sycamore stood the morning of September 11th, 2001. And nobody realized that what they were doing was matching up with the prophecy, I asked. There was no one putting it all together? No one, he answered. It's an exact, precise fulfillment of the ancient vow. It's exact. It's as if they're highlighting it so you can't miss it. That's the nature of the harbingers, Noriel. They have to be made manifest. They couldn't have matched it any more precisely than if they had recited Isaiah 9:10 word for word, and nobody was trying to make it happen. They all just happened to do it? Think about it, Noriel. Who could have put it all together? The tower fell because of the terrorists. It happened to fall exactly as it did in order to strike down that one particular tree. The tree just happened to be a sycamore, which just happened to be growing at the corner of Ground Zero. The tree that would replace it just happened to be given as a gift from outsiders who had nothing to do with anything else, but who just happened to feel led to give it. Their gift just happened to be the fulfillment of the biblical Erez tree, which just happened to be the same tree spoken of in the ancient vow. The tree that must replace the sycamore. They just happened to lower it into the same soil in that the fallen sycamore had once stood, exactly as in the Hebrew of the ancient vow. And the man who led the ceremony around the tree just happened to bring it all together without knowing that he was bringing anything together. No one knew what they were doing. It wasn't a matter of intent. It was the manifestation of the harbingers. It's mind-boggling, I said. And another replaying of the mystery. They were all stepping into the ancient footsteps, and they thought it was their own. It was their own, he said, but in the ancient footsteps. Another piece of an ancient puzzle falling into place, another reenactment of an ancient drama of judgment. It still seems like a movie. It's still hard to believe that it's all real, that it actually happened. It all happened and is happening. And what's the message of the Erez tree? The same message it carried to ancient Israel. The Ground Zero Tree of Hope was a sign, as it was proclaimed to be, but not of the hope they proclaimed. Instead, it was the sign of a nation's defiant rejection of God's call to return. And concerning the future, what does it mean? When you see the Erez tree planted in the place of the fallen sycamore, it's an omen, a warning. What does it mean for the future? One commentary in Isaiah 9:10 puts it this way. If the enemy cut down the sycamores, we will plant cedars in the room of them. We will make a hand of God's judgments, gain by them, and so outbrave them. Note, those are ripening apace for ruin, whose hearts are unhumbled under humbling providences. Ripening apace for ruin? Then there's no hope, I asked. There is hope, said the prophet. But when a nation such as this places its hope in its own powers to save itself, then its hope is false. Its true hope is found only in returning to God. Without that, its tree of hope is a harbinger of the day when its strong cedars come crashing down to the earth. He stopped walking. And now, Noriel, we approach the last harbingers, the last two, each as closely joined to the other as the Erez tree is to the sycamore. He handed me the next seal, the seal of the eighth harbinger, which I promptly examined. Its image was of some kind of platform, some kind of wide, low platform. I couldn't make anything of it beyond that. You're puzzled, he said, as he saw my reaction. Yes, I replied. This one doesn't look too promising. What else do you have to go on? The words of the vow? But the vow ends with the planting of the Erez tree, the cedar. There's nothing more. And what other clues do you have? I don't know. You forgot the other clues? There are only two left. It's a simple process of deduction. One is of stone. The Gazit stone, I replied. The other is fallen. The bricks are fallen. One ascends. It has to be the tower. One is alive. The Erez tree. And the other one was the sycamore. There are only two left, he said. Tell me again, I replied. One speaks of what is, and the other of what would be. One speaks of what is, and the other of what would be, very mystical and vague. The last two harbingers are not like the others, he said, and yet like all of them. Not like the others, and yet like all of them. I have to suppose that you believe you're helping me. I am, he replied. I need something more. You're right. The last two are harder than the rest. That's the clue? I asked. And not here, but far away. Far away? Far away like the mountain? Yes. As far? I asked. About as far, he replied. That doesn't narrow it down much. The prophecy will reveal it. Where it is? Yes. I don't see how. Until then, he said, and then left me there at the edge of the park. I shouted after him. You can at least say good luck, you'll be needing it. But I don't believe in luck, Noriel, he replied without turning back. He began crossing the street in a crowd of other pedestrians. I made my way to the start of the crossing, but went no farther. But if I don't know what I'm looking for, I shouted, how will I know it when I see it? You won't, he answered. I won't know it? No, you won't see it. And why not? He reached the other side of the street, stopped, and turned around to face me. Why won't you see it? He shouted across the street. Yes, I shouted. Because you can't see it. It's invisible, of course. He then turned around, resumed his walking, and disappeared into the crowd. Chapter 12. The Eighth Harbinger. The Utterance. So, she said, with a slight smile of amusement, you are now on a journey to find an invisible harbinger. Exactly, he answered. An invisible harbinger based on an unidentifiable image. An unidentifiable image on the seal? Yes. What about the other clues? Like, one speaks of what is and the other of what would be? Yes. What could I do with that? What was it revealing? He gave you other clues, though. He told me that the last two harbingers were unlike the others and yet like all of them. And was that a help? Does it sound like a help? Not a lot of help, no. The most I could get out of it was that each of the harbingers had to do with one piece of the mystery. But the last two wouldn't be about one piece, but about the mystery as a whole. Not like any of the others, and yet like all of them. Sounds plausible enough. Yes, but still leading me nowhere. What about the vow? Up to that point, everything was following the vow. Everything was taking place in order. There was nothing left. You had the bricks, the tower, the Gazit stone, the sycamore, and the Erez tree. It ended with, but we will plant cedars in their place. There was nothing else in the verse to give any clues. What about being far away? That was the one clue that actually gave me something to go on. How? I asked him if it was as far away as the mountain. He answered that it was just about as far. Pretty general. Still, it was something to go on. The mountain was about 4 hours away from the city. So the same distance would be... But about as far, she said, isn't equivalent to saying it's the same distance. Still, he replied, it could be the same distance. In any case, to be safe, I allowed a distance of 3 to 5 hours from the city. That's a few hundred miles. Then I drew a circle around it. With New York City in the center? Yes, to a radius of a few hundred miles, to see what it would include. There had to have been a lot of places. There were. New York State, New Jersey, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts, Maryland, Delaware. But how could that possibly lead you to find the Eighth Harbinger? It would be a needle in a haystack. It couldn't lead me, not without something else. But the prophet gave me one more clue. He said the prophecy will reveal it. So I looked again at the prophecy for something that could give me a clue to the place. And the only thing that I hadn't considered was the introduction. The Lord sent a word against Jacob, and it has fallen on Israel. All the people will know, Ephraim and the inhabitants of Samaria, who say in pride and arrogance of heart, the bricks have fallen down. How could you find a clue in that? She asked. The names, he replied. Ephraim, Jacob, Samaria, they were all linked to Israel. So the Eighth Harbinger was in Israel? No. Israel isn't exactly 4 hours away. I searched the commentaries to see what they had to say, if they could lead me to the missing key. And did they? Yes. So what was it? It was Samaria. Samaria? Isn't that almost the same as saying Israel? It depends. Samaria wasn't just another name for the kingdom of Israel. It was also the name of a city. The prophecy is directed at those who dwell in Samaria. Was it Samaria the kingdom or Samaria the city, or both? I have no idea, she replied, but why would that be important? The vow could have been spoken anywhere in the land and by anyone. It could have become a rallying cry or an anthem among the people. But it would only be significant if it represented the response of the entire nation. And who can speak for an entire nation? The leaders? Exactly. So Samaria was the nation's capital city, the seat of its government, the city of its kings and officials. For the vow to matter, it had to be spoken by the leaders. It had to be the nation's official response, so it had to be proclaimed in the capital city. And then I discovered a clue in one of the commentaries on Isaiah 9:10 that linked the vow to the nation's capital. National pride is usually most arrogant in a capital city. It's the key. The vow has to be proclaimed in the capital city. That's what I was looking for, the capital city. He paused, waiting for her to get it. Washington, D.C., she said. What were the two targets of 9/11, he asked. New York City and Washington. It was already connected. What about the distance, she asked. Did it fall inside the radius? Washington is just a little over 4 hours from New York City. The same distance as to the mountain. So if I was right, there would be some connection between Washington, D.C. and the words of the vow. If I was right, then somewhere in the capital city was the Eighth Harbinger. So that's where I had to go. But how would you know where to go once you got there? She asked. I wouldn't, any more than I knew where to go the other times. I just went on what I knew, or what I thought I knew. So where did you go? First to the Pentagon, the place with the most direct connection to 9/11. But my access was limited, of course, and nothing seemed to connect. The following day, I went to the White House, but again, no connection. After that, I went to the Lincoln Memorial. What was it about the Lincoln Memorial that you thought would connect? Nothing, he replied. But I always wanted to see it. And since I was in the neighborhood, I figured if I kept searching, I would end up in the place I was supposed to end up in, one way or another. So it was as good a place as any. And? I'd never been there before. It was impressive up close. Massive marble columns like some Greek temple and, of course, the statue, larger than life, noble, powerful. I was staring at his face when I heard it from behind. Consider the greatest of American presidents, said the voice. I turned around. It was the prophet. Before I could acknowledge his presence, he spoke again. And perhaps the most sorrowful, he said. Even in stone, it comes through. So I'm here, I said. I made it. You did, Noriel. I'm impressed. But I knew you would. He led me over to the side to look at the words engraved on the wall. Lincoln's second inaugural address, he said. And then began to read the words out loud. The Almighty has His own purposes. Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war, may speedily pass away. Yet, if God wills that it continue until all the wealth piled by the bondsmen's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with a lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword, as was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said that the judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. He paused and turned to see my reaction. Do you understand what it's saying, Noriel? That behind the war that was devastating the nation was judgment, a national judgment for the sin of slavery, until every drop of blood drawn with a lash shall be paid by another drawn with a sword. And so his sadness, I said quietly. But lying behind the judgment were the purposes of redemption, that slavery would be removed from the land. The Almighty has his own purposes. Yes, the Almighty has his own purposes. He began walking toward the entrance, but stopped just short of the steps, where he stood, silhouetted against the sunlight outside the memorial, framed between two colossal marble columns. He was waiting for me to join him, and I did. So we both stood there between the columns, looking out toward the reflecting pool, the mall, and the obelisk of the Washington Monument in the distance. So tell me, Noriel, how did you know? How did you know it was Washington? It was Samaria, I said, the capital city. The vow had to be spoken in the capital city. And why would that be? Because the capital city is the seat of the government, the place from which the nation is led. The vow only matters if it represents the will or voice of the nation, if it's the nation's response to God, and only the leaders can speak for the nation as a whole. Well done, Noriel. So, what would we expect to find in Washington, D.C.? Some link between this city and the ancient vow, I said. Somehow, Isaiah 9:10 has to be connected to Washington, D.C. Correct. In the days of Isaiah, the vow would undoubtedly have been spoken or repeated throughout the land. But the vow is proclaimed with authority and on behalf of the entire nation. It sums up the nation's response and sets forth its future course. Whatever else it may have been, the vow had to have been a public declaration of the nation's leaders. It had to be proclaimed somehow in the capital city. And so the eighth harbinger is what exactly? I asked. What's left in Isaiah 9:10 that hasn't yet been revealed as one of the nine harbingers? Nothing. It ends with the planting of the Erez tree. Nothing, he said. Then everything. What do you mean? I asked. I told you that the last harbingers are unlike the others, and yet like all of them. What did you make of that? That they wouldn't be so much about the individual pieces of the puzzle, but about the whole. Correct again. And what else did I tell you? That I wouldn't see them. That they were invisible. So put the clues together. It's about the whole. The whole of what? He asked. The whole of the mystery. And more specifically, the whole of Isaiah 9:10, the whole of the vow. So what then is the eighth harbinger? Isaiah 9:10? And when is Isaiah 9:10 invisible? When it's spoken? Correct. So the eighth harbinger is Isaiah 9:10 in spoken form? The eighth harbinger is the vow itself, proclaimed by the nation's leaders in the capital city, the spirit of defiance given voice, the pronouncement of judgment. The nation's leaders pronouncing judgment on their nation? Unwittingly, by publicly proclaiming the vow, they seal the nation's course, and by so doing pronounce judgment on the land. I assume you brought the seal with you? I took it out of my pocket and handed it to him. Were you able to figure out the image? He asked. No. It's a platform, he said, a speaker's platform, from which in ancient times leaders and orators would address their audiences. Then he lifted the seal in his right hand and began revealing its meaning. The eighth harbinger. In the aftermath of the calamity, the nation's leaders respond with public proclamations of defiance. They boast of the nation's resolve and power. They speak of its fallen bricks and quarried stones, its uprooted trees and their replanting. They speak of a nation defiant and resolved to emerge stronger than before. The words take the form of a vow. The vow gives voice to a national spirit and seals the nation's course. It all takes place in the capital city, the eighth harbinger, the utterance. The prophet stepped out from between the columns and descended a few of the marble stairs, then sat down. I followed and sat down beside him. It was the third year after the calamity, he said. Israel's calamity, I asked, or America's? It was the third year after 9/11. The pieces of the ancient puzzle were falling into place. In late November of 2003, the Erez tree was lowered into the earth to replace the fallen sycamore. On the following 4th of July, 2004, the Gazit stone was in turn lowered to the floor of Ground Zero to replace the fallen bricks. So by the summer of 2004, every object mentioned in the ancient prophecy had manifested, and each at Ground Zero. Less than 3 months later would come the manifestation of the Eighth Harbinger. But not at Ground Zero, no, in the nation's capital, where the nation's leaders reside. According to the mystery, it would have to involve at least one leader, one who could speak on behalf of the nation, a figure of national prominence. He would have to utter words paralleling the ancient vow. And all this would have to take place publicly. Yes. In the autumn of 2004, the nation was in the final stage of a presidential election. The candidate campaigning on the Democratic ticket for the office of vice presidency, a member of the Senate, was at that time among the most prominent of the nation's leaders. It was September 11th, 2004. The vice presidential candidate had been invited to speak at a gathering of a congressional caucus in the nation's capital on the anniversary of the calamity. It would be an eloquent address designed to inspire its hearers. It would also be a sign. What would proceed out of his mouth would be even more precise and more eerie than that which had been spoken over the stone at Ground Zero. September 11th, 2004, the third anniversary of the calamity. These are the exact words spoken that day in Washington, D.C., the nation's capital city. Good morning. Today, on this day of remembrance and mourning, we have the Lord's word to get us through. The bricks have fallen, but we will build with dressed stones. The sycamores have been cut down, but we will put cedars in their place. My God, I said, that's too... It is, said the prophet. Nevertheless, it happened. I can't believe it, but it happened. He said those exact words? Those exact words. But it's a prophecy of judgment. What was he doing proclaiming? That's the point. He proclaimed Isaiah 9:10, the code to the harbingers. It's too much, but it's real. Anna had been silent up to this point, just trying to take it all in. But she could no longer contain her reaction. It's totally unbelievable, she said. It's like something out of a, I know, he replied, but it's all real. When the prophet told you all these things, did you check them out to verify them, to make sure they actually happened? She asked. Yes, he replied. And they all checked out? Yes, they all checked out. It's so hard to believe. Now it's the vice presidential candidate saying it outright. This ancient mystery. It's beyond real. I know. I told him that, but it's all true. But why would anyone proclaim that vow, she asked. I asked the same thing of the prophet. And what was his answer? His answer was that it happened for the same reason everything else happened. It wasn't about the motive or the intention of the one doing it, but the fact that it was done, that it happened. It happened because it had to happen. It was another replaying of the ancient mystery. What the speaker intended to say was irrelevant. The words came out because those were the words that had to be spoken. The vow had to be proclaimed. The words of the ancient leaders over the ancient calamity had to be proclaimed by an American leader over 9/11. And by doing so, the two nations, the ancient and the modern, were bound together. The utterance would join the Assyrian invasion to 9/11, and America's post-9/11 defiance to Israel's defiance in the face of God's judgment. But how, she asked, did it happen that the vice presidential candidate could end up saying those words? That's the same thing I wanted to know. I asked the prophet how many verses there were in the Bible. Over 30,000, he told me. So, I replied, out of over 30,000 verses, that's the one he chose? And you said it was obscure? That even people who read the Bible every day would probably have no idea it existed? That is correct, he replied. So how on earth did he end up choosing that particular verse? How was the sycamore cut down, he asked. Through a series of twists and quirks. But now the twists and quirks take place in the realm of speech writing, in the searching through quotations deemed most appropriate for such occasions, in the borrowing of passages and quotes from other proclamations and speeches. It doesn't matter how it happened. The point is, it happened. One of the most prominent of American leaders had now proclaimed the ancient vow, one of the most obscure verses in the Bible, and one of the most ominous. And he, too, had no idea what he was doing or saying, I asked. If he had, he never would have done it. It's stunning. Yes, he said. It's stunning enough for Isaiah 9:10 to appear in a speech centered on 9/11. But that wasn't the end of it. It wasn't only that the ancient prophecy appeared in the speech. What else was it? It was that the entire speech actually emanated out of the ancient prophecy and revolved around it. The whole speech revolved around Isaiah 9:10, I asked. It was the cornerstone on which the speech was built. So an American leader built an entire speech on an ancient vow spoken in defiance of God by the rebellious leaders of a doomed nation? And lest the connection be missed, he proceeded to join the ancient words of judgment to America. How? He said this, "Let me show you how we are building and putting cedars in those three hallowed places." And again, "And in a place where smoke once rose, you and I, we will see that cedar rising." And yet again, "You will see that while those bricks fell and the sycamores cut down, our people are making those cedars rise." He's actually linking the fallen bricks of Ground Zero to the fallen bricks of Israel's judgment. Yes, Noriel, that's exactly what he's doing. But he doesn't stop there. He speaks as well of fallen sycamores and rising stones, the Gazit stone. Yes, and rising cedars, the Erez tree. And all referring to America's campaign to defy the calamity of 9/11, as he links it all to the judgment of ancient Israel. And then he crowns the address with a dramatic conclusion in the form of a final vow. "The cedars will rise, the stones will go up, and this season of hope will endure." And he never realized it, I asked. He had absolutely no idea what he was doing. His only intention was to deliver an inspiring speech, a word to encourage a nation. But instead, he was pronouncing judgment on a nation. "Yes," said the prophet. Without realizing the ramifications of his words, he was pronouncing judgment on America. Amazing! But so it was in the ancient case as well. Without realizing what they were doing, the leaders of ancient Israel were pronouncing judgment on their nation. But now it's 2,500 years later, I said. Now there's a context. The book of Isaiah, it's clearly not a word of encouragement. So it means nobody took the time to look even two verses back or ahead to see that it was actually a proclamation of judgment? No, because it had to be proclaimed. And yet, notice, Noriel, the senator made a subtle change. The original vow speaks in the future tense. We will rebuild. We will plant cedars. But in the speech, it becomes, we are building. We are making those cedars rise. Only at the end does it go back to the future tense. The cedars will rise. The stones will go up. Why do you think that is? When he speaks in the future tense, he's vowing. It's the vow. But when he speaks in the present tense, he's bearing witness to the fact that the vow is being carried out. Exactly. He's bearing witness that the vow is being carried out. And to do that, he takes hewn stones and cedars, the symbols of Israel's defiance in Isaiah 9:10, and transforms them into the symbols of America's campaign to rebuild itself after 9/11. Just as the actual physical harbingers were literally transformed into the symbols of American resurgence. Correct. Did he know what was happening? Did he know what was happening? Did he know that what he was declaring, figuratively and symbolically, was actually taking place in reality? He spoke of the falling of the sycamore as a symbol of 9/11. Did he know that it had actually happened? That a sycamore had actually been struck down on 9/11? And when he spoke of Americans putting up stones and cedars, did he realize that, too, had actually taken place? Did he know about the Gazit stone or the Erez tree? He was only speaking poetically. He had no idea. And even if someone was to report it to him, he still would have had no idea what it all meant, no more idea of what he was doing than those who actually replaced the fallen sycamore with the Erez tree and bricks with stone. Everyone was unknowingly performing their part of the mystery. And his part was to take the ancient vow and transform it. In his address, it ceased to be a quote. It was no longer Israel boasting in its cedars. It was now America. It was thus now America's vow. Everything was being transposed, the bricks, the quarried stone, the sycamore, the cedar, and now an American leader was publicly proclaiming the exact words of the vow and bearing witness of its fulfillment, a harbinger to seal the other harbingers and to reveal America as a nation under the shadow of judgment. An American leader pronouncing judgment on America. Without realizing it, yes, as the manifestation of the harbinger. So on the anniversary of 9/11, an American leader proclaims the ancient vow, pronounces judgment on his own nation, and he has no idea what he's doing or saying. As with all the other harbingers, he doesn't intend it or realize what he's doing. Nobody does. And yet it still all happens according to the ancient prophecy. Every piece of the puzzle falls into its exact place, but no one intends it to happen. No human hand directs it. It just happens. I still can't fathom it. The prophet paused before responding, then spoke, almost in a whisper. The Almighty, said the prophet, has his own purposes. He reached into his coat pocket and handed me the next seal. This is the last one, he said. The seal of the ninth harbinger and the last of the harbingers. Do I get a clue? I asked. You already have a clue. Not like the other harbingers and yet like all of them? Yes. So then the ninth harbinger is like the eighth harbinger? I asked. Like and unlike it. Is there a law, I asked, that if something isn't confusing enough as it is, you're required to make it more confusing? He didn't answer that. So the ninth harbinger is like the eighth harbinger in that it's a summation of all the harbingers that went before it, I asked. Yes and no, he answered. Do you see what I mean, I said, as if expecting him to commiserate with my plight. Yes, he answered. It is a summation, but no, not primarily of what went before it. Then of what, I asked? Of that which came after it. How could it be a summation of what came after it? The clue you were given, one speaks of what is, and the other, I said, the other of what would be. What is it that you see on the seal, he asked. It looks like it could be some sort of document. It is a document. It's a parchment, the kind on which the scriptures were written, the kind on which the prophecies of Isaiah were recorded. So the ninth harbinger is a document? It is, he said, but not primarily. Then what primarily? What is it that speaks of what would be, Noriel? A prophecy, I answered. The ninth harbinger is a prophecy? Correct. Then we have to look for a prophet? No. Then for what? He rose to his feet and began walking down the steps. Come, Noriel, and I'll show you. Show me the place where it all happened.